Hello and welcome to lesson number 3. I am Richard Nongard and I am glad that you have continued here in your studies. Today we're going to focus on mindfulness. The reason why we're going to focus on mindfulness is that this is a foundational skill in many of the different approaches to contextual behavioral psychology. Now, I hope that you followed up lesson number 2 by actually taking a moment to contemplate lesson number 2 and to really practice becoming aware of your own relational frames. You can even ask yourself the question, as a result of listening to lesson number 2, are you more aware of the relational frames that you create arbitrarily and automatically and subconsciously just by going throughout the day? Have you, as a result of learning about relational frame theory, been more aware of your thoughts and that you are like a fish, but instead of swimming in water, you are swimming in your thinking? In today's lesson on mindfulness, I'm going to begin by actually challenging a predominant viewpoint in therapy. Sometimes this is referred to as regress to cause. Sigmund Freud, of course, is identified with the basic idea of going back to an emotional root cause and creating change by creating catharsis. When we're talking about Freudian approaches, when we're talking about regression to cause, we're really talking about past tense therapy. Now, I recognize that many of us don't identify with being a Freudian, but his influence was so pervasive across so many years in our profession and continues to be, that really the ideas of Sigmund Freud, to a large part, are still a part of our everyday vocabulary in the counseling office. For example, do you use these questions or phrases with your clients? So tell me, what happened? Or this one. Let's go back and take a look at that and let's process what it felt like. Here's another question that's often used by therapists, even if they don't identify with a Freudian approach. How did you feel when? Here's another question that's often used in therapy. Go back now, maybe a week or two, maybe a couple months, maybe a couple years, maybe to a specific event or feeling or emotion, and let's talk about when that happened. Here's a question I hear all the time whenever I'm observing marriage and family therapists. And what did you do when fill in the blank? These really are past tense approaches to therapy. These are questions that therapists ask because at some level, there remains the belief that in order for me to be okay, I have to go back into the past and either resolve or relive or have catharsis or re-experience or reinterpret something that already happened. This whole philosophy is really based on the ideas of Sigmund Freud that somehow our past controls our present. Freud believed that neurosis is caused by unresolved conflict, and that by revisiting the past, the present will change. The primary mode of operation that Freud used then was catharsis related to those events. Joseph Breuer was a contemporary of Sigmund Freud, an Austrian physician as well, and the Breuer and Freud theory was that symptoms are caused by repressed emotions, not repressed as in forgotten, but, you know, underlying in the subconscious mind. So they're repressed emotions, and this was based on an observation they made. This is what Freud wrote in his one of his books. Each individual hysterical symptom immediately and permanently disappeared when we had success in bringing clearly to light the memory of the event by which it was provoked, and thus arousing its accompanying effect. In his later work, Freud actually looked back on these early cases and he really wasn't completely satisfied with the results of catharsis. These were his theories. In fact, by the end of his career, he actually rejected the whole cathartic component of therapy. Freud's major contribution from a theoretical perspective was actually made in his latest years of life, the id, the ego, and the superego. But it seems as if his early theories of repression and catharsis and really what some refer to as regress to cause are still the predominant legacy of Sigmund Freud. In the early 1970s, Arthur Janov elaborated on Freud's ideas, and he claimed that if infants and children are not able to process painful experiences fully, for example, to cry, sob, wail, scream, whatever, in a supported environment, then their consciousness splits. Pain gets suppressed to the unconscious and reappears later in neurotic symptoms and disorders later in life. According to Janov, painful experiences become stored and need to be released in therapy by reliving and discharging suppressed feelings. Janov claimed that cathartic emotional processing of painful early life experiences and the process of connecting them with the memory of the original event could fully free clients from neurotic symptoms. But Janov, and certainly his predecessor Freud and Breuer, as well as a number of others, were really theorists. These were not empirically validated techniques. In fact, the vast majority of Sigmund Freud's writings are simply case studies, observations that he made. When we're talking about contextual behavioral psychology, we're talking about evidence-based treatment. We're talking about literally thousands of peer-reviewed journal articles measuring the efficacy of the therapeutic approaches. And while none of us would probably be here without people like Janov, without people like Freud, without people like Breuer, or other theorists from an earlier time, the reality is these approaches are not regarded as effective approaches in the current era. Here are some of the problems with these really predominant approaches whose legacy still lives. One, regression is only a metaphor. It's actually not a reality. It's impossible to see things today from the same vantage point as yesterday. The whole idea that we can go back and we can see something and experience it as we experienced it then is really just a metaphor. It's not an actuality. Memory itself is unreliable. It's flexible and it's adaptable. You know, one of the researchers in this area, Elizabeth Loftus from the University of Washington, I'm paraphrasing here, but basically has said, what the mind cannot recall, the mind will create. This is why you can have two siblings who have an entirely different recollection and memory of what their childhoods were like. Memory is notoriously unreliable, not only when we're talking about an adult reviewing what happened when they were a child, but in the couples who I work with who are in my office and are reviewing what happened last week. One of the other problems with these approaches is I think it assumes a certain level of therapeutic narcissism, that I, the awesome therapist, will be able to review a person's life and their history and pinpoint, quote-unquote, the cause that's causing today's distress. That's really a rather narcissistic presumption in therapy. In fact, it's my belief that life is a cause of the problems. For all of my clients presenting problems, there's usually not a cause. There are usually a multitude of causes. Contextual psychology tells us that cause is not something we really need to be concerned about in order to experience change. The fourth problem with this historic approach is that either through analysis or free association, the research shows the methods to be ineffective. They've been discarded by psychiatry, psychology, and medicine for the better part of the last 50 years, and to continue to embrace the what I call past tense therapy approaches really denies logic, history, and the overwhelming evidence of today's research. And of course, focusing on the past, it's a labor-intensive endeavor. It's not consistent with short-term therapy. We live in the world of managed care. Sigmund Freud's idea was, if the client comes and sees me every single week, twice a week, for a period of 10 years, at the end of 10 years, we will have restructured their personality. And, all right, we'll just for the sake of argument, give Freud credit that that was a possibility. But the reality is, in the era of managed care, limited time, and limited resources, none of us have the ability to focus on the past. We don't have two sessions a week for a period of 10 years in order to restructure personality. We probably have 21 days max per calendar year of inpatient care, and we're probably capped to six sessions with the utilization review board that we're dealing with for outpatient therapy. And focusing on the past is just a labor-intensive endeavor, and it's really not consistent with the requirements that many of us have with providing short-term therapy. So really, what is the alternative? Contextual psychology, it is the antithesis of Sigmund Freud's approach. Freud, by the way, even though, as you can tell, I'm not one who has bought into the vast majority of his psychological theories, is still an important person. His contribution was, of course, the organization of psychology as a discipline. Up until Freud's time, theology was the queen of the social sciences. It was Freud who juxtaposed those positions and created a new queen of the social sciences, being the discipline of psychology. And of course, his organizational structure is still the organizational structure that, to a large part, is reflected in the pages of the DSM-5. Contextual approaches are present focused. They don't search for a cause, but rather they train a client in a new skill, a skill of acceptance, and one that we're going to spend a fair amount of time in each of the following lessons really focusing on. While many traditional approaches to therapy may have really dwelled on the past, the foundation for contextual psychology is helping our clients to live fully in the present. And this is done by teaching a skill to them. Mindfulness is a skill that is taught to clients. I see myself as a teacher of the clients who I'm with. And in almost every single first session I do with almost every client who comes on my office, I teach this basic skill of mindfulness to my clients. In fact, with the vast majority of my clients, I probably teach them a basic strategy for mindfulness within the first 30 minutes. And by the way, when I teach this to my clients, none of them say, "Wow, that was incredible, Richard. That was the most awesome experience I've ever had." In fact, when I'm done in that first session teaching them a basic strategy for mindfulness, they almost always respond with, "Well, I guess that was relaxing," or I guess I can see how that could be helpful. The value in mindfulness is not in guiding a client through a basic process in our office. The value of mindfulness is in teaching them a skill that they will practice on their own between sessions so that they can cultivate living fully in the present. And what happens to almost all of my clients is in the second or third or fourth session, when they come back, there comes a point when they say, because they've been practicing every day, "Wow, I now recognize why the first session was so important. I'm actually living mindfully. In situations where I used to automatically become anxious, I am automatically being mindful. In situations where I would respond with an impulsive behavior, I'm responding with mindful awareness." Mindfulness is not a new idea. In fact, the basic tenets of mindfulness, to some extent, are probably 5,000 years old. But the application in psychology is new, and the reason why is psychology is new. Up until 100 years ago, we always understood human behavior in context of religion, theology. Buddha did not know that he was starting a religion called Buddhism. Buddha really was, to a large extent, one of our first psychologists. And Buddhism is a religion which recognized, being one of the oldest religions, the value of cultivating mindfulness. And so sometimes when people hear about mindfulness, they think I'm going to be teaching Buddhism. Usually, by the way, this is not clients who wonder this. They're more than happy to learn these things. But usually it's other therapists who wonder if I'm a Buddhist psychotherapist. I'm not a Buddhist psychotherapist. In fact, I actually said to somebody who asked me this not too long ago, if I were to teach this to those who are Buddhists, they would say, "Wait a minute, but that's not Buddhism." Because an idea or a technique or a strategy for problem resolution originated within a theological frame of reference does not make it that religion. Simply put, we've been trying to understand ourselves for the last 5,000 years. And most people throughout history have tried to understand that through a theological lens. And so it's no great mystery to me why Buddhism addressed a subject that really is ultimately about psychological health. By the way, Buddhism certainly isn't the only religion to address the concept of mindfulness. Jewish meditation, Kabbalah, Islamic meditation, Christian meditation. In fact, Matthew 6:28, when Jesus talks about the lilies of the field not needing to worry about what clothes they will wear, it is really the same concept of mindfulness that other religions have talked about. So mindfulness is not in and of itself religious, even though religions from around the world have certainly utilized the concept of mindfulness. Here are some definitions of mindfulness. Bringing one's complete attention to the present experience on a moment-to-moment basis. Jon Kabat-Zinn has written, mindfulness is paying attention in a particular way, on purpose, to the present moment and non-judgmentally. Bishop gives us a definition. The first component of mindfulness involves the self-regulation of attention so that it's maintained on immediate experience, thereby allowing for increased recognition of mental events in the present moment. The second component involves adapting a particular orientation towards one's experience in the present moment. An orientation is characterized by curiosity, openness, and acceptance. And that's really my favorite definition of mindfulness, because I think it really describes fully what it is that my clients need to know in order to experience change in therapy. The idea of mindfulness, staying in the moment, might sound simple, but these are actually skills that need to be taught to a client. I view myself as a teacher in my sessions, or at least in part of my role as that of teacher. And so I teach them how to practice mindfulness. It is not something that happens organically just because they come to therapy each week. A big part of the homework that I assign to my clients is to practice 2 minutes of mindfulness with intention each and every day between now and their next session. By the way, that's the great thing about mindfulness. It's not about meditating for 30 minutes or 45 minutes or funny postures or wearing funny clothes. In fact, a person doesn't even need to be still in order to practice mindfulness. You can mindfully shop at the grocery store. You can mindfully walk. You can mindfully be still in a chair for a period of time. You can mindfully eat a raisin. Mindfulness is not about a specific style or vantage point of meditation, and it certainly is not about clearing one's mind. The goal in mindfulness is not to empty one's mind or to stop thinking. In fact, to the contrary, it is to simply give us time to allow ourselves to observe ourselves swimming in our thoughts. Probably the easiest way, again, to demonstrate mindfulness is to actually share with you and go through the same process that I use with my clients in their very first session. And so I'm going to take probably the next 7 or 8 minutes, and I'm going to guide you through a simple process, the same process that I utilize with my clients. And chances are pretty good when we're done, your experience will be, well, it felt great to get CEU hours with the eyes closed. But unless you've done this or practiced this before, it probably won't be earth-shattering for you. But your assignment at the end of this lesson, lesson number 3, is to, with intention, practice mindfulness each and every day, twice a day, for the next 7 days. That's the same assignment that I give my clients. And I guarantee that if you do the assignment, then you will find what my clients find, and that is they find that when they cultivate mindfulness, the value of it is incredible. And when I'm done guiding you through this process, I'm going to talk a little bit about the research, and I'm going to talk a little bit about how mindfulness can enhance our ability to be a more effective therapist. Also, I want you to know that in the notes that accompany this course, I provided a script that is different than what I'm going to go through now, but it's similar. It's a very basic process in mindfulness, and I've included that with you so that you can actually have it in front of you and go through clients or guide clients through this. So I would encourage you to print out this section of the notes, cut and paste it onto a piece of paper, set it on your desk, and when you're teaching clients a basic strategy in mindfulness, feel free to actually read from a script until you have it committed to memory. It's a great way to begin actually applying the principles of contextual psychology in our offices with our real clients at 4:15. This is the mindfulness meditation week one practice. Like an athlete or a musician practices for a performance, mindfulness meditation is our daily practice for living life to its greatest potential. Each day for the first week, listen to this file 3 times a day, practicing the methods it contains. Please practice using this sound file. There are 3 components to the practice. First, the practice of directing your attention to your breath. Second, practicing how to return your attention to your breath anytime you notice feelings, thoughts, or sensations. The goal is not to stop thinking, stop feeling, or to stop having sensations. The purpose is to simply note when you do this, and to practice bringing your attention back to a focal point, in this case, the breath. The third part of this practice is to begin to notice how easy and natural it is to stay in the present when we notice our attention drifting into either the past or the future. Notice during this week times when you mindfully and intuitively return from distressing thoughts, feelings, or sensations back to your breath and to the present. As you sit in your chair with your body relaxed and your posture in alignment, close the eyes and breathe in, noticing what it feels like to breathe in. Scan your body and let loose any muscles that are holding tension. Relax the jaw, let the shoulders drop. And you can let your eyelids and hands be heavy with relaxation and just breathe. You don't have to try to speed up or slow down the breath during this exercise. All you have to do is breathe and pay attention to your breath. There's not really a right way or a wrong way to do this exercise. It's simply the practice of bringing your attention to your breath. Observe the breath, noticing the tempo of your breath, the temperature of the air. Observe how the air flows in and what it feels like to flow out. We breathe every day, often without noticing it. And by practicing an awareness of the breath, we're really practicing an awareness of this moment. After all, this moment, this breath is really all we have. And of course, as long as we're breathing in this moment, even if life still surrounds us, we're okay. As you breathe in and out, label the breath. Call it by its name. Label the breath in and call the out breath out, saying to yourself, in and out. Notice the air as you breathe in and the point where the air in your lungs turns around and becomes an exhale. As you pay attention to the breath, you'll also notice you are aware of sounds, sensations, and experiences apart from your breath. The practice is not to stop noticing those things, but rather, when you notice thoughts and awarenesses outside of the task of paying attention to the breath, simply note that you're doing that and return your attention to the breath. If you notice yourself thinking about anything at all, you don't have to try to stop thinking. Rather, just note the thought instead of following it. Simply say to yourself, that is a thought, and bring your attention back to the breath. If you become aware of an emotion or a feeling during this time, it's okay to have them. The practice here is not to suppress them, but not to follow them. to simply note them and say, that is a feeling, and return your attention to the breath. Likewise, if you have any sensations, if your body feels something, you can simply note, that is what my body feels. That is a sensation, an experience. And without becoming engaged in it or following it, just use it as a cue to return your attention to the breath, noticing what it feels like to breathe in and out. Over the next 2 minutes, continue to breathe in and out, paying attention to your breath. I will let you know when the 2 minutes begins and when the 2 minute ends. The practice is, of course, to simply note when your mind begins to follow a thought or a feeling or an awareness of sensation, and to gently, without judgment, return your attention to the breath. It doesn't matter if you need to do this many times. The value is in developing the practice of returning to this moment by returning your awareness to this breath. And begin now. And our two-minute time period has ended, so pay attention to the next breath, breathing in and breathing out, paying attention to it and reorienting yourself to the floor below you, the air in the room around you, and opening the eyes. Although almost everyone can see the value in this exercise, most will discover the real value comes with practice. During this week, as you practice this exercise, begin to be aware of and notice when you intuitively begin to practice mindfulness and mindful awareness of the moment in other situations during the week. For example, if you're stressed in traffic, you might notice when you become aware of this stress, that you automatically focus on your breath rather than letting the stress become a thought you follow. By the end of your first week of practice, you'll begin to notice how natural and easy it is in a variety of different situations and places to mindfully focus on 1 minute at a time, 1 moment at a time. What does the research tell us about mindfulness? One of my favorite web pages on the internet is scholar.google.com. Normally you go to www.google.com, but replace the www with the word scholar, so it's scholar.google.com. This is one of my favorite web pages, and I'm surprised how many people don't know scholar.google.com exists. Instead of giving you a bunch of things that people are selling, which seems to be what regular Google gives you, Scholar.google.com only gives you peer-reviewed journal articles, textbooks, and other academic publications. This is a great resource for any therapist. You can search the current literature. You can search the history of literature. In fact, I've actually posted in the notes for this course a link to an interesting journal article on what the research says about the effectiveness of mindfulness as an approach in psychology. And this is actually a journal article that's reprinted on the APA's webpage. So you can find all kinds of great things in scholar.google.com. I don't know what type of clients you work with, but just type in the type of client you work with and the word mindfulness therapy or mindfulness or mindfulness meditation or mindfulness-based approaches, some combination thereof. For example, I work with smokers, so I might type in smoking cessation mindfulness into scholar.google.com. If I type it into regular google.com, I'll get a bunch of people selling meditation CDs. But if I go to scholar.google.com, I'll find out what the research actually says about using mindfulness as a strategy for helping people stop smoking. I work with obese clients. I work with a lot of clients who are catastrophically obese. I mean, my typical weight loss client is 45, 50 years old. They're men. They're 400 pounds. If they don't lose half their body weight in the next 2 years, they're probably going to die as a result. And so obesity, mindfulness into scholar.google.com. And what you'll find is amazing. You'll find for almost every area where we work as clinicians, there is a mountain of evidence showing the efficacy of mindfulness-based therapies in helping people to experience success. Here are some of the really universal outcomes of teaching mindfulness to clients. It seems like a simple strategy, but I've learned that sometimes what's simple is really most effective for my clients. Clients who are taught and practice mindfulness reduce their rumination. Now, again, because I'm a marriage and family therapist, I'm really familiar with the problems of rumination. Most of the couples who I work with, their problems are directly tied to one or both of them ruminating about the other person for the past 5 or 10 or 15 years. My depressed clients are ruminating about their depression. My anxious clients are ruminating about their fears. Mindfulness reduces rumination, and the research shows that. It reduces stress. That's really important for my medical clients. I see a fair number of medical clients with significant complications. In fact, the book I wrote on medical meditation quoted 297 different studies that demonstrated that those who learn mindfulness prior to surgery have three predictable outcomes. One, it decreases complications. Two, it increases the speed of recovery. And three, it decreases the dependency on medications. Think about the diabetic clients you work with. Think about the clients with chronic pain. Think about the clients who work in a stressful job situation. For those of you doing therapy in EAPs, mindfulness is going to be one of the most effective strategies you can teach clients. Mindfulness actually improves memory function. It enhances focus. I don't work with adolescents anymore. I did for a number of years. I have my own adolescents. Fortunately, actually, my kids are now leaving adolescence entirely, which is awesome. But the only adolescents who I do see are those who are top performing students, and I see them for test taking anxiety, and I use mindfulness to help them enhance their focus. Mindfulness, the research shows, decreases emotional reactivity. Think about the clients who you work with. Do you wish that they had a decrease in their emotional reactions to the events of life and the experiences they have? Many of our clients are in our offices because they don't have emotional control over their reaction. And the research shows those who learn mindfulness have decreased emotional reactivity. They have greater cognitive flexibility. They're able to consider new and different options. There's documented research to show that those who learn mindfulness improve their relationships, and this can be and should be a chief strategy in marriage and family therapy. Lots of journal articles on applications to pain control, eating disorders, ADD, ADHD, impulsivity, marriage counseling, anxiety, personality disorders, depression, and many other commonly treated issues in therapy. And I think the research that Marshall Linehan's done into dialectical behavioral therapy in the arena of personality disorders is absolutely a fascinating application of mindfulness and something we're going to spend an entire lesson on coming up. When therapists practice mindfulness with intention, do they derive a benefit in their therapeutic practice? There's actually research to show it increases a therapist's self-efficacy, their ability to develop attentional processes to increase their own patience and intentionality with clients. It helps them develop skills which actually make them more effective. You know, when you take this course and you actually do the assignment and actually practice this every week and become a more mindful person, you'll be excited to pass along this strategy to others. By doing this yourself, you'll develop skills which make you simply a more effective therapist. Increased empathy and the development of a non-judgmental compassion, which is, of course, we know, one of the foundations of effective therapy. Now, I want to share with you some textbooks. There are a ton of resources and textbooks. I'm not going to provide simply a bibliography section. What I'm going to do instead is I'm going to provide you, really, probably not in each lesson, but every couple of lessons, some basic texts which could be helpful if this particular lesson was useful to you. And some basic texts on mindfulness and psychology that can be useful to you that I always recommend to therapists are, number one, a book called Full Catastrophe Living: Using the Wisdom of Your Body and Mind to Face Stress, Pain, and Illness by Jon Kabat-Zinn. Jon Kabat-Zinn is a neuropsychologist at the University of Massachusetts Medical Center who's been working in the area of chronic pain for the past 30 years. Thich Nhat Hanh was a Nobel Prize nominee, Peace Prize nominee. He is a Buddhist monk who lives in France. He wrote a book titled Here You Are: Discovering the Magic of the Present Moment. And one of the things that I really appreciate about Thich Nhat Hanh is that although I do not share his Buddhist religion, he explains the ideas of mindfulness, even though he's a Buddhist monk, in a very non-religious way. Mindfulness in Plain English is another textbook which is often recommended by people. It is a book that I have found particularly useful as well. And so those are three books that can really help you to understand the value of mindfulness in psychology. Now, in most of these lessons, I'm also going to give you a homework assignment. Lesson number two's homework assignment was simply to pay attention to the relational frames that you create. But this assignment is a little more specific. I'd like you to practice that mindfulness exercise each and every day, taking the time to actually practice intentional mindfulness each day for 7 days. To help you do that, I have created a YouTube video, and I put a link in our in the handout for this course. And you can feel free to share this link with others, even if they're not taking the course. In fact, you can give it to your clients to help them practice mindfulness. And this video is basically me taking a few minutes to guide a person through that exact same process that I guided you through a little while ago. And I always encourage my clients to use this video each and every day with intention to go through the basic process of mindfulness. When they have acquired the habit of doing this, they of course no longer need to listen to the video. The MP3 or the video will get a little bit redundant after a couple of days. But by then, you should know how to actually take 2 minutes or 3 minutes of your time and devote it to intentionally practicing the art of mindfulness.